Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello, and welcome to the War Room podcast. I'm Jacqueline Witt, professor of strategy at the U.S. Army War College and the War Room podcast editor. Thanks for joining us today. Today's program focuses on the vexing problem of securing the victory. That is, how best to ensure the gains made by military action can achieve the strategic objectives for which the conflict was waged. We need not look very far in the past to find examples of failure or challenges in this respect. We could look at Reconstruction and Redemption in the South following the American Civil War, to the Civil War that engulfed Iraq in the wake of the American invasion in 2003. But this problem has challenged strategists and planners for much longer than that. And many of the major theorists of war and strategy have tackled this problem. Karl von Clausewitz warned that in war, the result is never final, which reminds us fundamentally that victory and peace are fragile. And even after an enemy is defeated, securing the victory is deeply political and it requires strategic thinking of the highest order. The questions, then what, or what's next, must be consistently asked questions for strategists and planners. And so if preventing war and preserving peace is a primary function of strategic education, then we would do well to explore this topic in depth at the War College. So we're very happy today to have Bill Flavin and Scott Braderman in the studio to discuss this complex and important topic. Bill is the Assistant Director of the Peacekeeping and Stability Operations Institute, or PKSOI, which is part of the Army War College, and Scott is the Chief of Research, also at PKSOI. So let's join these two gentlemen in the studio.
Thank you, Jackie, for that wonderful lead-in and setting the environment for today's discussion. In the words of military historian and theorist Sir Basil Henry Liddell Hart, if you concentrate exclusively on victory, with no thoughts for the after effect, you may be too exhausted to profit by the peace. While it is almost certain that the peace will be a bad one, containing the germs of another war. Iraq is very illustrative in this venue, as military strategists and planners give little thought to the rebuilding of Iraq after the cessation of hostilities, often known as the Golden Hour, thus missing an opportunity to marginalize power brokers and expand on euphoria of an abdicated repressive regime. The population was ripe for change. Professor Flavin, could you describe what is meant by the Golden Hour in terms of stabilization?
Hey, thanks, Scott. You know, several years ago, Colonel Rick Schwartz joined us as a member of Peacekeeping Stability Operations Institute. Rick had been the leading commander of the 1st Battalion into Baghdad when Baghdad collapsed. And Rick told us he was standing around in the dust of collapsed Baghdad when Iraqis came up to him and said, "Thanks for getting rid of Saddam. What do we do now?" And Rick said he had no answer. No one had told him, "What do you do now?" Shop owners, educators, political leaders, local notables were coming to him daily, giving him plans, giving him recommendations on what should go ahead, and he was getting no instructions from higher whatsoever other than just to entertain the locals. And later, when the civil disobedience started and civil unrest started to happen, he was told just to let them have their way. Obviously, as we all know, the rest is history. So, what could we capitalize at that golden hour? Now, the RAND Corporation currently is talking about the golden hour. What is this golden hour? How do we know it's there? How do we capitalize on it? And how do we move ahead? As some wise sage used to say, I think it was the catcher for the New York Yankees, Yogi Berra, "It ain't over till it's over." And that's the true nature of these conflicts, not over till it's over. General Hicks, who was previously a deputy G357 at headquarters DA, used to have a slide that he would take around. It's a slide of military engagement over many years throughout history. And in the slide on the far left-hand side showed a little red line, a tiny little red line of the actual conflict force on force, and then a long blue line that snaked its way all the way across the slide, showing the extensive engagement of the U.S. military in trying to secure the victory and trying to secure national objectives, which, of course, is the real challenge.
Based on that, do we really understand the problem? And have we realistically learned from our lack of post-conflict planning in Iraq and Afghanistan that we could apply to a post-ISIS in Iraq, post-resistance in Syria, or any number of other potential post-conflict situations?
Learning from the past. That's an ugly thought. I'm not really sure. I like to be optimistic. However, I got to remember in 1755, the British Army in North America, shaken by the defeat of Braddock on the banks of the Monongahela, transformed itself. But by 1758, the British Army had changed its tactics, uniform, organization, training, and equipment to deal with the challenges in the North American continent in trying to secure their long-term struggle in that area. But the transformation was expensive and unsustainable after the war, and the British government, driven by ideology, fiscal, and political necessity, restructured its force to deal with global responsibilities, fell back on the default standing operation, and 13 years later, we all know what happened. In 1966, the U.S. Army, shaken by its experience in Vietnam, transformed itself so that by 72, the Army had changed its doctrine, tactics, uniform, organization, training, and equipment to deal with the challenges of the complex environment that it faced. But driven by ideology, fiscal, and political necessity, after the fall of Saigon in 75, it reverted to its default organization and doctrine to face the Soviet threats, based on the assumption that these lesser low problems, low-intensity problems, these long-term engagements before and after could be handled by a few special units and ad hoc responses. 25 years later, we faced the problem again, Afghanistan and Iraq. And today, in response to the continuing conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, the U.S. Army and the Joint Force has modified its doctrine, tactics, uniform, organization, training, and equipment to deal with these challenges. But again, driven by ideological, fiscal, and political necessity, and in the face of the challenge of Russia and China, what are we going to do? I think it remains an open question.
So what has changed over the past nearly two decades in policy, concepts, and doctrine to address these challenges?
Well, in fact, there's been a lot written and a lot thought about it, and there has been some change. There's a joint concept for integrated campaigning that's currently out there, and that joint concept recognizes that the military focuses itself primarily on the Phase 3 combat operation phase and not enough on pre- and post-conflict. So there's a recognition of our joint concept to get at these problem sets. Our doctrine has changed, joint and army doctrine. It takes a look at conflict transformation, taking a look at getting from the initial conflict into sustained peace. It takes a look at the fact that conflict is endemic in the world and what we need to do through various messages of economic, political, ideological, personal, and others is to change the nature of conflict and gain some stability. The military does very well in terminating conflict, less well at resolving some of the basic underlying issues that caused the conflict in the first place, and is not as great as transforming it, transforming the base problems to sustained peace. That requires an interagency, multi-agency approach, and the approach of the host nation as well. And the doctrine recognizes this. The doctrine recognizes that, in fact, it is political and not military at the base of the problem. And, of course, we have to dig up Clausewitz every now and then. I'll dig him up again and have him sit next to me here, in which Clausewitz said, "The main lines upon which military events progress are political lines that continue throughout the war to the subsequent peace. To bring a war or one of its campaigns to a successful close requires a thorough grasp of national policy. On that level, strategy and policy coalesce, and the commander-in-chief is simultaneously a statesman." What that means, of course, is that the military must understand political dynamics as well as the political understanding the military dynamics of security of this situation. And I think the doctrine has gone a way to do that. It takes a look at whole of government. It takes a look at the long gain. It talks about this political reality. And so I think our doctrinal base is probably sound and can be used quite well. Policy-wise, starting in 94 in Haiti, we began to develop some policy that went ahead and took a look at how do you get to long-term stabilization. The policy initiative was continued, and however, currently, since 2011, based on the fatigue of our engagements, the NSC directives have kind of dried up in that area. The policy initiative from the Department of Defense is still there. The 3005 stability policy is under revision now and is going to be moving forward. What about the whole of government policy? Well, a 3D paper was produced for the transition team recommending some policy initiatives to begin to grapple with these problems. And Department of State, in support with the NSC, has done a whole of government assessment of stabilization. And so there are some actions out there afoot in order to take a look at the policy developments that are there. We remain hopeful that something might happen in this policy development world, because olive oil policy is key and essential, because it is not possible to conduct these operations successfully without a whole-of-government approach, and not possible to conduct it without the host nation in collaboration with the whole-of-government.
Do we have an integrated education strategy that encompasses interaction with international and interagency partners while also inculcating the skills of a master politician into our combatant commanders?
Well, education is the key. It's been demonstrated again and again that education and understanding and the networking that education has among all of the various agencies provides the baseline for success. Education has always been an issue. Ike Skelton drafted legislation for national security professionals. The legislation has not gone too far. They're always talking about national security professionals and larger professional education, but again, the wind has gone out of the sails for that adventure. As we know, various agencies conduct their own separate education and stovepipes and invite each other to attend each other's schools. Capacity limits those that can attend, but those that have attended each other's schools have benefited, and the whole-of-government approach to these problems has been good for those people who have gotten together and done that. So this is a continuing challenge out there, and I think, you know, there are some initiatives. The Army War College has done a study on this, as other institutions, and hopefully education will be part of some new initiative.
Since our doctrine is based on transformation and transition, is that possible? What are the conditions that must be in place for this to happen?
Well, that is a challenge because all of this is conditional. It takes a certain environment, and the vagaries of the world have to come together in order to make this happen. And it has happened before. Japan has transitioned, as you know. Korea, which when we took over Korea after World War II, was considered a backward country with no traditions, was incapable of entering the modern era. Democracy was not possible, and you see Korea today. Francis Fukuyama has a very good study on Korea, and others have a very good approach on how to develop it. But the environment is key, the nature of the society, the nature of the conflict itself, on and how the conflict was unrolled, the regional dynamics of the countries around it are key and important to do this, and the global networks that connect the various countries and the transnational actors are key and essential on this. Leadership is one of the key issues, and right now we're finding more and more as we investigate that leadership of females are key and important toward long-term stabilization. We can see that in Rwanda. We can see that in the coast of West Africa. And this is a key and essential thing that needs to be looked at much more into the future. The domestic environment inside the United States is also essential. The leadership inside the United States, the capacity and capability of the United States to respond, our own unity of effort, our own level of understanding and political will, and the resources to sustain this over a long time. And then the ability for us to get together and plan and execute successfully.
Considering recent initiatives such as the Stability Assessment Review and the 3D paper, are we any closer to achieving the essential operational synergy of unity of effort?
Well, we know that unity of effort can occur out there. We've seen it. U.S. Institute for Peace has done a couple of case studies, one on Boko Haram, another one on Jordan, in response to the ISIS problem and the refugees in Syria. And in those cases, local unity of effort did work, did bring things together, were able to get the authorities and monies necessary, were able to have a coherent narrative and show some progress. So at a localized level, at an embassy level, it does seem to be able to function. Can we take this and then abstract that to a international or national level? Well, it remains to be seen. There is a lot of energy out there to do this, a lot of interest to try to address the world in a coherent manner. So maybe using these examples that USIP has just put together, something might be useful.
In a perfect scenario, what are your recommendations for moving forward from here?
Well, some of the recommendations has to be is we need, there is support that's needed, support from the Hill, legislative support, because authorities are key and essential. It's nice to have the words, but if you don't have the money, you don't go anywhere. So you need legislative support. As earlier, Ike Skelton and Israel and others, Biden, when he was on the Hill, provided support in order to look at a more holistic approach to these problems. So taking a look at that, taking a look at the initiatives that are out there today with the 3D paper, with the State Department's assessment of stability, and trying to move that ahead. And in each department, trying to keep their eye on the bubble and not going back to the 1775 discussion, where we thought that maybe we could just throw this together at the end and pull it off, and it didn't quite work out for the British. That problem is always in our face. So I think always talking about it, always thinking about it, writing about it, and pushing. It'll have to be that way because by nature the U.S. government does not come together normally. It's not designed to come together in a coherent way, so it always pushes back against one. So it's a constant battle, a constant pushing, but hopefully we can keep our eye on the ball.
Well, thank you very much for the discussion today. It seems like we have a lot of challenges still in front of us, but it appears the doctrine concepts are all headed in the right direction, and synergy is hopefully on the forefront, especially working with all of our interagency partners. So we've got challenges, but it doesn't look like they're insurmountable. Again, thank you very much for your time today.
I thank you.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.